Before we get into today's episode, we'd like to say something. This episode is published on June 6, 2020, 12 days after the murder of George Floyd, a black man, at the hands of white police officers. This is one of the most recent incidents in a pattern of white violence against black people, a pattern that stretches back across the years, decades, and centuries, and is indelibly woven into the very founding of the country that Benny and I, and many of our listeners, live in. On The Doctor's Watcher, we believe that Black Lives Matter. I won't put words into Benny's mouth, but personally, I believe in punching Nazis, I believe that all cops are bastards, and I believe that a lot of cops are Nazis. We encourage you to find some charities and organizations that you believe in, that support the advancement of equality, or bail funds for protesters, or anything else along those lines, and donate some money to them. If you've already done so, that's awesome. Think about doing it again. And I encourage you to find some black voices to listen to. Benny, anything you want to add?
Kyle covered most of what I wanted to say, so I'll just add that sometimes when a problem is as huge and overwhelming as this one, it can feel like nothing we can do as individuals can make a difference. Please don't let a feeling of helplessness prevent you from doing what you can. Donate to bail funds, boost black voices, support black-owned businesses, educate yourself and others, and speak up whenever you see racism. Anything you do, no matter how small it may feel, does make a difference.
And now, please enjoy the regularly scheduled Doctor's Watcher.
Hello there, I'm Benny.
And I'm Kyle.
And you're listening to The Doctor's Watcher.
This is the podcast where I watch Doctor Who and I tell you all about it.
Hey, Kyle.
Hey, Benny, how's it going today?
Well, we're still sheltering at home, so that's going on. But I had the day off, so I just played a ton of No Man's Sky today.
Oh, nice. I've actually been meaning to check that out, but never have.
I get a feeling that you'd quite enjoy it. It's, some of my friends call it Space Minecraft. And, yeah, it's just like you fly around space and have adventures and, you know, explore planets, see the procedurally generated weird-ass aliens that are walking around. Procedurally generated plants and minerals and mine them and harvest them and then build a base. And you can look like a weird alien.
Nice. That definitely sounds like fun. I can imagine it would make a good escape from the current dystopia that we live in.
Yeah, there's some of that. I think any escape from this current dystopia is valid, but yeah. It's nice. You can go to like a nice calm world and just sort of run around harvesting stuff and building your cute little base, and or you can go to a terrible irradiated death world, and you know, as long as you stay mostly indoors, you'll be safe. Wait a second, this is starting to sound familiar again. Maybe that's less of an escape, I don't know.
Well, I have been becoming progressively more and more surrounded by boxes. As you know, Benny, but I don't think our listeners necessarily know, because I don't think we've mentioned it yet on the pod.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think we mentioned it.
But I am in the middle of a move. My partner and I bought a house like just before the whole world got locked down into a pandemic. And so now we are planning and beginning to execute a move from one house to another house in the middle of all this bullshit and nonsense.
Oh my God. Kyle.
By the time people hear this episode, theoretically, if all goes well, we will have moved quite some time ago. This comes out in June, it looks like. And so by the time people are hearing this, hopefully I will be like comfortably settled in my new place for like at least a month.
Cool.
But yeah, that is at the moment well in the future.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'll probably actually still be somewhat surrounded by boxes when people listen to this, but they will be boxes that will be becoming emptier and emptier rather than fuller and fuller. Mm-hmm. Editor's note, Kyle here. I just wanted to say that I am, in fact, editing this episode from my new office in my new house. My house is full of boxes, but the office only has a few. So
should we get into it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, let's get some escape from nonsense and
yes.
Escape from dystopia.
Yes.
So this is season 1, episode 15, The Singing Sands.
Cool.
And
cool. I like the kind of fantasy adventure sound of that.
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty fun name. Like it, you're not quite sure what to expect from it, but
yeah,
it's definitely kind of like a, I don't know, Legend of Zelda type.
Yeah, exactly. Something. That's the vibe.
So you may recall that we are in the middle of our first missing serial.
Mm-hmm.
Not a single episode of this serial is still in existence, as far as we know.
Mm-hmm.
And the previous one, I watched a Loose Cannon Reconstruction, which was, you know, based on telesnaps and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a Loose Cannon Reconstruction for this one as well, except this time, rather than the original black and white Loose Cannon Reconstruction, I watched a colorized version, and that was pretty cool.
Oh, weird.
Yeah. It was actually really interesting to see a colorized version of the opening theme and, like, the opening title sequence.
Uh-huh.
All the, like, trippy psychedelic grayscale blobs.
Did you just like make up colors for them?
It was basically just a single color filter over the entire screen. But that filter would kind of change between like purple and then yellow and then green and stuff.
That's fun.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Cool. Yeah, so one of the things I've been thinking about between episodes is that your experience of watching these deleted lost episodes is very different from when you watch the episodes that we still have. But my experience of listening to it is pretty much the same. So, I mean, normally, you know, as you tell these stories, I'm sort of imagining them, picturing them in my head. And then that's the same, like the characters and stuff, and it feels the same regardless of whether it's an episode that we still have or not. So, it's weird. It's like every time you mention that, oh yeah, and these are the lost episodes, I have to kind of stop and be like, yeah, oh, that's right. Like Kyle didn't actually watch it. I'm watching it, you know, in the theater of the imagination, same as always. But you didn't actually get to watch it on your screen.
That makes sense. That's actually kind of similar to when I first listened to the audiobook version of the episode versus then when I later watch a Loose Cannon Reconstruction.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just, honestly, to me, it's almost part of the charm of Doctor Who that some of it is lost. It kind of gives it that air of mystery or something. Yeah. It's kind of fun.
Yeah,
I mean, totally. Also, it kind of sucks. It kind of sucks, but it's also kind of fun.
But it's also kind of fun. So do you remember what our Cliff Dingler from last time was?
Oh, we had some shady dudes making some shady deals to poison all our adventurers, you know, like our usual, the Doctor and his companions, and then Marco Polo and his party, and then the warlord was going to like kill them all, poison them while they were out in the desert.
Yeah, the plan was basically that he's going to go out in the desert with them, and he's going to poison all their water gourds except for their first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I guess on the third night, like by that time, presumably they'll be running out of their first water gourd.
Mm-hmm.
So on the third night, he's going to sneak away and meet up with the shady dude. And, you know, they'll just like chill out for a few days while all the poison takes its course. And then they'll head back out into the desert to just like collect the TARDIS for themselves.
I did like the meow. Hi, Matilda. I did like the detail of poisoning the other water gourds, except for the first one, so that they're like too far out in the desert to turn back.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty clever.
Yeah, for a couple of shady dudes, they're pretty smart.
Yeah. So the first scene is, you know, as usual, just the last scene of the previous episode. It's T'Gana talking to Shady Dude about their plans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I did want to mention here that our reconstruction is based on static images, but it's not just entirely static, because our quote-unquote camera will like zoom in and like pan across these static images and stuff.
They're trying.
Yeah, it was kind of.
I mean, you know, they're working with what they got.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So we get a great telesnap image of the TARDIS, like strapped up on the back of this, you know, 16th century Asian sledge.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And
was it a model, or did they build like a full sized? Or just grab a police box, I guess. Was it a full-sized TARDIS?
I'm pretty sure it was full-size, actually. I'd have to take another look. But, yeah, I felt like it was full-size rather than our little 6-inch TARDIS.
Yeah, I guess it might be harder to tell the difference between a full-size TARDIS and the like model if all we have is still photos.
Oh,
if you don't see
true,
like people in the shot.
And we then get an Indiana Jones-style map with a line on it.
I love them.
Did we have that in a previous episode? I don't remember.
We did. Yeah, okay. in this one, actually. I mean, in this serial.
The
previous episode had one of those.
Yeah, so we get another one of those with Marco Polo narrating. And he complains in this narration about how he's had to endure the Doctor's insults for like 3 days of travel now. Which is pretty good. At this point, Marco is rationing the water. And for some reason, the Doctor's not eating with everyone else. So Susan takes him his food, and Marco challenges Ian to a game of chess. This is, you know, after the narration, I guess. We've, like, reached the next destination on the map.
Mm-hmm.
Or the waypoint overnight.
Also, educational content. Chess has been around a long time.
That's true. So Susan comes back to, like, to the main tent with the Doctor's plate of the Doctor's untouched food, and then she just kind of storms off. So Barbara goes after her to find out, you know, like, what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that Susan's just really upset with the whole situation, which is understandable because, you know, obviously Marco is planning on giving the TARDIS away to Kublai Khan. And, you know, Barbara's like, don't worry, like, we'll sort something out. You know, it'll be fine. And Susan's like,
how? Ian playing chess with Marco? Grandfather being rude and sulking by himself?
But Barbara says that she doesn't think he's sulking. She says,
well, you know him better than I do. But I'd have said he was just feeling defenseless. He has a wonderful machine capable of all sorts of miracles. It's taken away from him by a man he calls a primitive.
So, yeah, basically Barbara's like, he's not sulking. He's just a condescending asshole.
Well, the two are different.
Uh-huh.
And Susan's like, thank you for making that distinction.
Yeah, like Susan
that
actually
really helps.
Susan does actually seem kind of cheered up by this.
Okay.
And she heads off to bed. Of course, Susan is still sharing a room with Ping Cho. And Ping Cho hasn't gone to sleep yet, so she and Susan talk for a little bit. And Ping Cho starts talking about how beautiful the desert is at nighttime when the moon rises. She says,
it is like a great silver sea.
And Susan's like,
metal seas of Venus.
Yeah. Which actually are silver seas.
Uh-huh. And Ping Cho's like, where? Susan's like,
oh, a long way from here.
So I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, I do like these kind of casual mentions of other things that we haven't gotten to see.
Right.
And but they sort of build the world and give us that kind of subtext for the characters.
Yeah, totally. Susan,
like,
actually,
apologize. I was going to say I'd like to apologize to our like lit major, lit theory listeners who are probably like, Benny, that's not subtext. It could be. I don't know. Maybe it couldn't. I'm not. Anyway, if I'm using these words wrong, I've probably been doing that for various things all along.
I'm sure
apologize.
We both have. This is not a podcast where we use words correctly.
No, I'm afraid that our rhetoric and lit theory technology is not very advanced.
Susan actually tells Ping Cho that she's never seen a moonlit night before, which I thought was kind of strange.
Huh. Like, maybe she just meant on Earth or on the desert or something.
Yeah, I think she must have just meant, like, in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she actually said that she's never seen a moonlit night.
I've never seen a moonlit night.
I have literally never been outside at night.
Uh-huh.
Except for when there's no moon at all.
So Ping Cho says that she'll call Susan in like 2 or 3 hours when the moon rises.
You know what, Kyle, I thought of something. Maybe it's because Earth only has one moon, so she's never seen a moonlit night. She's only been outside on other worlds that have many moons, so she's seen moons-lit nights.
She's seen moons-lit nights, but not a moonlit night.
Yes.
Yeah, that must be it. In her time on Earth, she's only been outside at night on cloudy days or on the new moon.
She had homework. The next day was a school day.
Oh, yeah, that's true. So Barbara, we cut back to the main tent, and Barbara comes back in and from the outside, and she's also talking about how beautiful the desert is at nighttime. And Marco Polo is like, yeah, but it's also pretty fucking dangerous. And Ian says,
like my queen. Check.
And takes a move in his chess game.
Stop paying attention to things actually threatening our lives. Pay attention to our chess game.
Uh-huh. Tagana's like, ooh, burn. Can you save your king? And Marco's like, dude, totally. Check. As he takes a move.
That would have to be a heck of a move to both get him out of check and put the other guy into check.
In one move, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of makes me wonder, like, what was going on with Ian's game there.
Yeah, I kind of feel like this is something that we probably lost along with the episode. This is clearly the most important detail that we will never recover.
So we cut to a few hours later. That was all we got there, was just, you know, that little bit of the chess game. And a few hours later, Susan and Ping Cho are sneaking out of their tents to go check out the moonlit desert. Susan says that the night sky is crazy, which I thought was kind of an odd term, or interesting term to use. Personally, I try to avoid using that term as a pejorative. It's kind of ableist, but, you know, they didn't know that in the 60s, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, Ping Cho is like,
crazy.
And Susan's like,
means I dig it. You know? Like it.
There we go.
Ping Cho says,
this language of yours is very strange.
Are you sure it's English?
I thought that was pretty funny. Like,
yeah, it's kind of cute.
I think we may have talked about it before. Somehow they can all understand English, but Ping Cho has trouble with slang English. I also thought it was pretty funny that she thought, like, this was strange. In 1964, they had no idea, like, how wild slang would get. You know, imagine Ping Cho's reaction if Susan had said, like, groovy or sick.
Just nonstop memes.
So the girls see Tagana leave his tent, and Tagana goes and talks to the guard for a moment and then walks off, and they decide to follow him.
He is pretty shady.
Yeah, I'd probably want to see what he's up to as well. Back inside the main tent, Ian and Marco Polo are both awakened by the sound of horses, and Marco says that they're restless and that there's a sandstorm coming.
Cool. Possibly singing sands.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. That's just speculation at this point.
Ian wonders how bad it will be, and Marco's like, bad enough. So Marco heads off to go tend to the horses. Mm-hmm. We cut back to the girls, who are still following Tagana, but they're having a hard time keeping up with him. Susan's struggling to catch her breath, and, you know, they talk for a minute and end up deciding to head back. But before they can start heading back, Ping Cho notices the oncoming sandstorm. Mm-hmm. And she says that there's no time to get back to the tent, and they must shelter in place. Of course, we all know what that's like.
Nice.
They get overtaken by the storm.
Well, and what can they do, though? Just sort of, like, hunker down? Try to dig a little hole?
It's not entirely clear.
Okay.
I think because we've just got the reconstruction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What we did see were some lovingly reconstructed images of basically static images of Ping Cho and Susan with sort of a layer of, like, what looks like kind of just snow or static or something kind of superimposed over them.
Okay. I always like the low budget special effects.
And, you know, we have audio of them screaming and wind blowing and whatnot. But yeah, that's basically what we get, is just this loose cannon special effect, which is, you know, pretty fun, actually, for what it is. We cut back to the main tent, and Barbara is like, what the fuck? And Ian's like,
don't be afraid, Barbara, it's a sandstorm. Sounds as though all the devils in hell were laughing.
Yeah, but, you know, that's chill. It's totally not scary at all.
I might not put the clip from the show in here. We'll see. The background noise of the sandstorm itself was pretty terrible, so it's not really great audio.
Mm.
Then again, I had to listen to it, so maybe I'll make all you listen to it
too. Suffer!
Thank you. Barbara says that it's terrifying, and Marco Polo kind of, well, actuallys her. He says,
"Not always, Barbara. Sometimes it sounds like musical instruments being played, a clashing of drums and cymbals. I've heard it sound like a great many people talking as they tramped across the desert. It can also be like a familiar voice calling your name. You're not the only one to be afraid. Travelers of the Gobi Desert have good reason to fear the singing sands, Barbara."
So she says it's terrifying, and he starts out with "not always," and then talks his way around to "you really should be terrified of it.
Oh, you don't know how bad it is, let me tell you."
At least we did get the customary burst of confetti and fireworks when he said the singing sands.
Okay, yes.
Ian,
I'm glad that that was somehow like preserved, even when the episode was lost.
Yeah, I think they must have like shown a clip of that in some other BBC show, and so then they were able to like harvest the, you know, just that clip of the Doctor Who episode from the archives of that show.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Dalek Kyle. I hope you are enjoying this podcast. If so, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes and tell your friends about the podcast. If you are not enjoying it, you can leave a 5-star review anyway to give Benny and I a false sense of security. Thank you for listening.
Ian is amazed that the Doctor is sleeping through all of this, but Marco is like, T'Gana is not sleeping through it, he is gone. And Ian's like, whoa, what the fuck? And Marco's like, if he finds shelter, he'll be fine, there's not shit we can do about it anyway. Barbara decides to go check on the girls, and, of course, is horrified to find that they're also missing. She tries to rush out to go searching for them, but Marco and Ian both stop her, saying that she'll be lost in seconds if she goes out there. Meanwhile, out in the sandstorm itself, Susan starts hearing what sounds like Ian's voice calling her name. But I'm pretty sure it was actually just supposed to be, like, the singing sands themselves. You know, Marco had, like, said, like, sometimes it sounds like a voice or whatever, a familiar voice calling your name.
Yeah.
She starts calling back, you know, "Ian, Ian, we're here!" But then she screams as T'Gana appears in the sand. The camera cuts back to the tent, where Ian is, like, still in the tent with everyone else. So I think that's, like, confirming that Susan had just heard the sand. Ian wants to go out searching, but Marco won't let him go, like, before morning, basically. But we, the viewers, get to see that T'Gana, like, sees the girls. I think that's basically all we get to see at that moment, just that he sees them.
Yeah, suspenseful.
We cut to what I assumed was probably a few hours later. The noise of the sandstorm in the background is gone now, and Barbara doesn't want to go on just sitting around and waiting for morning. She wants to go out and look for the girls. But then T'Gana enters the tent with the girls. Barbara, of course, is like, "Susan, what the ever-living fuck? We were so fucking worried all night!" And Marco Polo is like, "Yeah, for fucking real, holy shit, don't do that again! You either, Ping Cho! And what the fuck were you thinking, Tigana, taking them out like that in the night? And Tigana's like, dude, I didn't take them with me. I fucking found them.
Mm.
And Marco's like, so, what the fuck were you doing out there then? Of course, we, the viewers, remember that this was the third night, which was the night that Tigana's going to sneak away after having poisoned the water guards.
Nice of him to come back then, I guess.
Yeah, I thought that was, you know, like he didn't have to, like, save the girls.
Whom he's going to presumably allow to die anyway.
Right, yeah. So Marco, you know, obviously wants to know what Tigana was doing out in the sandstorm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, taking a walk.
Just stretching my legs.
And Marco is basically just like, yeah, whatever. I'm going to make the guards tell me if you leave again. Let's get fucking ready to pack up our camp and head out, even though we haven't slept all night. We can't waste water just fucking sitting here in the desert for a day. Gotta keep moving. The doctor, I should mention, is not in this scene at all, because he still has, like, slept through the entire sandstorm. They talk about it for a minute and decide that they don't really need to tell him about, like, Susan and Ping Cho sneaking off and stuff. I guess they're just trying not to worry him.
Huh. Well, I guess they've already yelled at her, so...
Yeah. We get another brief interlude where Marco Polo records his next captain's log. Writes in his journal.
Yep.
He expresses his gratitude for Tigana saving the girls, and he says that they made it about 15 miles the next day before he called it for the night. That night, the next night, in their bedroom tent, Susan and Ping Cho are talking to each other, and Susan's like, isn't Tigana full of shit telling Marco that he was just taking a walk? I don't think he's the type of man to just, like, take a walk because it's a nice night.
He doesn't care about the moon.
And Ping Cho's like, but he's the super important emissary of Kublai Khan's enemy coming to negotiate peace. I don't think someone like that would lie. And Susan's like, yeah, that's why it's fucked up that he did lie.
Uh-huh. Good point.
Uh-huh. Back in the main tent, Tigana is like, yo, Marco, what are you doing? And Marco's like, I'm writing in my journal. And Tagana's like,
I have to narrate an episode here.
What was that? I missed.
Sorry, I talked over you. I said, I'm trying to narrate an episode here. What were you saying?
And Tagana's like, nerd. While he sharpens his sword.
You know how to read. Dork.
Tagana's like, all right, man, you write in your little book. I'll take care of the horses tonight. Oh, also, I can just give the guard his instructions. But Marco's too smart for that. He's like, no, dude, send the guard to me. I'll give him his fucking instructions for the night.
His instructions are, keep an eye on me. I'll just tell him. I'll just be like, hey, keep an eye on me. If I do anything shady, tell Marco.
Uh-huh.
I'll totally tell him that.
So Tigana heads outside, and he makes some kind of noise to distract the guard. And the guard gets lured away from the wagons. And while the guard is distracted, Tigana goes over and slashes and drains the water gourds.
Hmm.
Next morning...
So what's the point of slashing and draining the water gourds if they were already poisoned?
I started to wonder if he actually did poison them. I kind of think that maybe
he... Dang it, I forgot something.
Yeah. That's my working theory.
He like goes through his stuff and he finds the poison packets and they're still like sealed and he's like, ah, Tigana, and you know, womp womp.
Or maybe when he went to poison him, he found out that like the lid had come off and now he's just got like poison all over the inside of his bag. But he can't really pour it into the water gourds anymore.
Tigana, why are you trying to shove your socks into the water gourds? Oh, I'm foiled.
So the next morning, Marco is like, well, guess we have a day of water left. 3 or 4 days if we ration it. I guess it turns out that should be enough to get them back to Lop, where they came from, mm-hmm. not where they're going. But Marco basically says that it's a trap. He says that this is something that bandits often do. They'll follow a caravan into the desert for a few days and then slash their water gourds at night, so they're forced to turn back. And then a couple days later, once they're weakened from the lack of water, the bandits attack.
We thought Tagana and Shady Dude were coming up with a super clever plan. It turns out it's just like bandit special number A.
Uh-huh. So Marco doesn't want to turn back because, you know, it's a trap.
It's a trap!
He says, or he thinks, he says there's an oasis, but it's like a week's journey away. And, you know, remember, we've got like 3 or 4 days of water if we ration it.
Mm-hmm.
Ian thinks that they should risk it and head to the oasis. And Marco ends up agreeing.
Based on Ian's, you know, extensive desert traveling experience. Right.
Tagana is like, fuck that. I'm going to go back to Lop. Just give me my share of the water that we have and I'll GTFO.
Hmm.
But Marco is like, nope, not going to happen. I'm responsible for your safety and we're all sticking the fuck together. We skip over like the next 5 days through another captain's log journal entry. Where Marco talks about how they're making less and less progress each day. They made like 20 miles progress on the first day, but by the fifth day, they're only making like 2 miles.
Yeah, because they've got no water.
Right. And yeah, so basically, they're just fucked at this point.
Mm-hmm.
We get a lot of great shots of everyone in the caravan just kind of standing around looking desperate under awnings and shades.
And the doctor's like, yo, I've got a water machine. You know, I've got a water fountain on the TARDIS.
Yeah, I guess they're not allowing the doctor into the TARDIS at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it that it's like their prize for Kublai Khan.
Right.
You think someone would be like, yo, we don't actually have to die.
Like, I think maybe the water machine was broken or something. I'm not entirely sure, because it seemed like when they landed in the roof of the world that a bunch of shit was broken in the TARDIS.
Mm.
And, like, you know, the doctor's been talking about how it's going to take him a few days to fix stuff up.
Yeah, I do remember that.
So, you know, headcanon speculation, but maybe the water machine's broken.
I think that's a fair assumption, yeah.
I was really glad that they took so many telesnaps of these episodes during the production. And, you know, that there are all these photographs that the reconstructions could be made from.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently there's this guy named John Kura who took these photographs during the production of the episodes and would sell them later. Mostly to the actors and directors as examples of their work that they could, like, put in their portfolio, basically.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. He ran a business doing this from 1947 until 1968 and would apparently take usually, like, 70 to 80 telesnaps per episode.
Hmm. And yeah, that's so weird, but yeah. I guess that... Yeah, in a time before people were recording episodes and when clearly the recordings would often be lost, they'd be like, oh, look how handsome I look, you know, look how good a job it looks like I'm doing in this still photo.
Right. But, you know, that was all they could do, I guess.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I guess it's because of that that we have all these reconstructions.
Yeah, shout out to John Kura.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea if I'm saying that correctly or not.
Well, it's, at least maybe C-U-R-A. I'm just aiming for consistency.
I also want to mention here, now that we're getting, you know, this montage of shots of everybody standing around in the midday sun, mm-hmm. I wanted to mention that Barbara and Susan and Ian have all had costume changes at this point.
Cool.
To fit in with everyone else. Ian is wearing that cool, like, high-buttoned collar, long-sleeve shirt style that's popular among Asian men.
Uh-huh.
And Barbara is protecting herself from the sun with one of those, like, conical rice hats. And Susan's got, like, a nice silk dress that I'm assuming probably belonged to Ping Cho.
Yeah, I do have to wonder, like, how accurate these costumes are.
Yeah. Yeah, my assumption would be probably not very, but at least they're trying.
Yeah.
On the BBC part, at least. I imagine, you know, in-universe, they're probably intended to be entirely accurate.
Of course, they came directly from the people who made them here in the authentic real world.
In fact, probably we shouldn't even assume that Susan's dress belonged to Ping Cho. It very well could have come from the TARDIS wardrobe.
Hmm.
But it's, you know, the correct silk style of dress, same style as Ping Cho's.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, of course, is still wearing his full suit and tie and hat and everything as usual.
Mm-hmm.
So Marco distributes the water ration to everybody, but the jug runs out. This is the last water anyone's going to get until they reach the oasis, and he has no idea how far that is.
Time to start drinking your pee.
Tagana is like, look, my horse is still doing all right. How about I go to the oasis? You all just wait here, and I'll bring the water back.
What a guy, that Tagana.
Marco is like, okay, cool, go ahead. But we're not going to be waiting here. I think we're going to try to keep moving as much as we're able to.
Mm-hmm.
And Tagana rides off on his horse. As everybody else gets ready to head out, the doctor collapses from weakness. Marco wants to set up a cot for him inside their wagon, but Barbara and Ian manage to convince Marco Polo to let the doctor rest inside the TARDIS, where he'll be much more comfortable.
You know, when the doctor kept being, like, off on his own and being, like, all cantankerous and stuff, there was honestly a part of me that was wondering if he had some secret, like, you know, doctor space wizardry technology food and drink that he had that he didn't want to share, that he couldn't share. There's only enough for himself, but, you know, he's just been sort of kicking up his heels and eating his delicious, like, you know, bacon and eggs and water in a bag and things like that.
But yeah, I think that's definitely a valid speculation, but yeah, I think they've had the TARDIS, like, pretty well under guard.
Yeah, yeah, so, I was wondering if he might have had some on him, but clearly not the case.
Yeah. But yeah, so they convince Marco to let him rest inside the TARDIS, and Marco even allows Susan to go into the TARDIS with him, but he says that Barbara and Ian have to stay out, and they agree. Ian is like,
Marco, without water, the doctor isn't going to last 24 hours.
And Marco responds,
none of us are, Ian, without water. Our fate rests with Tagana.
Well, you know, good luck with that.
That's certainly not foreboding.
Nope.
We cut to Tagana, who is at the oasis now, and he's having a nice drink from a full water gourd.
He's just like, he's on a beach chair. He's got a little umbrella in it. He's like, life is good.
Kicking back. You know, he kind of signals for the waiter who brings him in a new water gourd full of water. And after he quenches his thirst, he shouts,
"Here's water, Marco Polo! Come for it!"
As he pours the rest of the gourd out onto the ground.
Ooh, dick move.
Yeah. I do have to say, in the reconstruction I viewed, they did have a telesnap of him, like, pouring the water out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I could see what he was doing. But earlier, when I just listened to the audiobook, I'm sure the narration, like, mentioned what he did.
Mm-hmm.
But it sure sounded like he was doing something else.
You just hear the water hitting the sand.
Uh-huh. Which, you know, it would be an equally...
Yeah, here's your water, Marco Polo.
In any case, he says his line, the screen goes dark, and the title, next episode, The Cave of 500 Eyes, appears on the screen.
Dang, these are some good episode names.
Yeah, I thought so too. Like,
yeah, every one of these
best episode names of any serial so far.
Any one of these could be a good D&D module.
Yeah, totally. I would definitely love to run the Cave of 500 Eyes for the Outcast Trio.
Overall, all the episode, or a lot of the episodes, not just in this serial, but through Doctor Who, have had really good names. Like, you know, the Cave of Skulls, what was it? There was some sort of like Forest of Death or something.
Forest of Fear.
Of Fear, yeah. Yeah, there's, like, that's cool. I dig it. And like, at least it puts, I think, the audience in mind of this adventure that's gonna, you know, that you're about to watch, whether or not that actually delivers. And at least, you know, you're approaching it, you're ready for that sort of thing, and you're receptive to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is really cool.
Yeah, totally. Well, and I guess this is gonna be our second Cave of episode.
Mm-hmm.
As I recall, in Cave of Skulls, I think they didn't even mention the cave until like the very end of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully Cave of 500 Eyes will deliver a bit sooner.
Well, cool. Yeah, this was a good one.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this one, actually. I think, yeah, the serial so far is shaping up to be pretty interesting.
For all that I complained about the historical ones being more boring, I kind of like this intrigue and... you know, interesting stuff going on with the various characters trying to do different things and antagonizing our heroes to different levels. You know, I'm thinking like Marco Polo is not really cooperating with us. Like, he basically stole the TARDIS, but then like Tagana is like clearly all bad at this point. So different people with different motivations.
Right.
I dig it.
Yeah, like, Tagana's the villain, but Marco Polo is not necessarily, like, a protagonist.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's also sort of a villain in his own lesser way toward our heroes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And, like, the structure of this one's been pretty interesting so far as well. You know, how they're kind of, like, thrust into this adventure unwillingly, and... you know, we kind of get these, like, Indiana Jones map scenes where we progress from one location to another, and then we, you know, play out our little level there, and then move on to the next little level, and...
Yeah.
I also kind of feel like this is the serial that has had the most time compression in it as well, because of the same thing, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
we'll have... you know, 30 seconds of Indiana Jones style map based narration that just skips over like 5 or 6 days.
Mm-hmm. I like, he called it a captain's log. So I like the combination of the Indiana Jones map with the Star Trek style captain's log message. All sorts of good, good fandom stuff.
I mean, I call it as I see it.
Cool.
Cool. Well, I believe probably on both of our ends, there's going to be some dinner ready soon.
Yeah. I probably shouldn't stick around too much. But I will say I looked up some of the actors because you'll recall I was sort of curious if these folks are basically in yellow face or brown face, depending on their characters.
Right.
Some of them do seem to, like you said, be legitimately of some sort of Asian ancestry. Like I looked up the actress who plays Ping Cho. She's I think it said half Burmese.
Oh, that's cool.
And then others seem to be not at all, as far as I can tell. So at least, you know, for some of them, it seems to be at least a little bit, I don't know. Overall, I feel like it is a product of its times. And I know we've been saying that kind of all along in many ways for many of these episodes. But I think of all the things that were sort of like, you know, oh, the feminist moments, or like the way that they treat young people, mm-hmm. you know, like very much infantilizing Susan and things like that, which is also, you know, I know tied up with the way they treat women.
Right.
I feel like there's a lot that hasn't aged well, but the one that might bother me the most is, yeah, when they clearly just have white actors playing these roles for characters of color. Not that any of it is great.
Yeah, I think I would tend to agree with that.
Yeah, and I do try to, you know, evaluate the story on its own merits as the narrative that they're telling. Like I do think, like I was saying, that this is kind of an interesting and exciting adventure as
right.
these things go. I just like
the novelization is probably great.
Yeah, you know, the casting in the theater of the mind is whatever you need it to be, which is also, like, you know, for me, as someone who's sort of imagining it, of course I do my best to imagine the characters as appropriate to the time and location. But yeah, that's a thing.
Yeah, your imagination's probably generally better casting than the show itself in that case.
Yeah, and every time I have, when I picture like Ian and Barbara and stuff, I think especially Ian. No, especially when I picture Susan and Barbara, I always forget like how incredibly 60s-tastic their hairstyles are.
Uh-huh.
They're pretty. What's the word that Susan used? I dig it.
Yeah.
I dig their hair.
Yeah, I dig it too.
Cool. Well, thank you for watching Doctor Who and telling me about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Did you have anything else in your notes that you want to go over, or should we wrap it up?
I think that's about all that I had.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Well, listeners, we'll see you again in 2 weeks.
Join us next time and find out how many eyes the Cave of 500 Eyes really has.
I was going to say, I think we know how many, but maybe the budget, yeah. the scenery design or whatever it is. We'll see what we end up with. Cool.
Cool.
All right. See you, Kyle.
See you. Hi, Kyle here. The Doctor's Watcher would like to thank Circuit 23
for the awesome theme song he created for us. You can find his music, including our theme, at soundcloud.com/circuit23, and you can reach him at circuit.23@gmail.com. Thanks to Benny for listening to me talk about Doctor Who, and thanks to all of you for listening to Benny listen to me talk about Doctor Who. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at thedoctorswatcher@gmail.com or on Twitter at Doctor Watcher. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you review your podcasts. Join us next time on The Doctor's Watcher.
I find it a fascinating game of strategy of war. Two equally balanced armies deployed upon a field of battle, and each commander determined to be the one who cries Shamat.
Shamat? Checkmate?
It means the king is dead.